Welcome back. College is an objective for millions of young Americans. Advanced education is considered a ticket to good jobs and a good life, but it is an expensive ticket, often putting students and/or parents deep into debt. Nationally, the bill is more than $1 trillion and growing, surpassing credit card debt in this country. The St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank is hosting a day-long symposium today on the subject of student debt and ways to address it. Its title, Generation Debt, the Promise, Perils, and Future of Student Loans. Joining me to talk about the debt issue is Brian Noeth, a policy analyst at the St. Louis Fed Center for Household Financial Stability. Matthew Newland is Assistant Director of Financial Aid at the Brown School of Social Work at Washington University in St. Louis. He has worked in financial aid for 7 years now. And Joey Khoury is a double major junior at St. Louis University. He plans to graduate early next May, then go on to graduate school. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us. Nice to see you.
Great. Thanks to be here.
Okay, Brian, let me start with you. The key word in the title of today's symposium is peril, I assume.
Student debt has increased a lot over the past 5 years, 10 years. It's grown from about $360 billion in 2005 to about almost over $1 trillion today. So, you know, this is kind of a big burden on a lot of families.
Perilous in what ways?
It obviously, people coming out of college, it actually is, can be very burdensome. You have a lot of people not making payments. It affects people's ability to start new businesses, you know, buy houses. It has effects on consumer activity and just well-being.
We hear about the potential for a bubble here. Explain that potential.
So, I think people a lot of times compare it to the mortgage market. I wouldn't necessarily say that. It's a little bit of a different animal. It's, not nearly as large as the mortgage market was. It's mostly held by the U.S. government, so there's not really systemic risk, but it's bubble-esque if you think about the rapid increases.
Mm-hmm. Let me turn to Matt now. Matt, you've been at this for 7 years, as I understand it. How has this whole situation changed over those 7 years?
I think the biggest change from my perspective is how much more cognizant students are of this situation. Students I have coming to me now, they're aware of this $1 trillion idea. They're aware that they, you know, could be paying for, you know, upwards of 10 or 15, 20 years. Whereas, you know, a few years ago, it wasn't at the forefront of their mind. They just assumed everyone takes on student debt, so I'm going to do the same. And now they've done their research. They've read, you know, the news articles. They've listened to the interviews. And it's at the forefront of the mind when they're deciding where to go to school.
How did we get to this point?
A lot of it is the rising cost of tuition. A lot of it is students not taking the time to think about how much loans they need when they accept their aid. They're accepting everything that's offered because they think they have to, instead of saying, well, I only need a portion, so I'm only going to accept, you know, 3/4 of what's offered. But the rising cost of tuition has been a big part of it. So it's sort of a combination that's led us to where we are. And honestly, we have so many more people, such a larger percentage of the population going to school. That's mainly why it's bubbling up like this.
And at Washington University, it's certainly not the exception, but that's a pretty stiff bill to pay at that institution.
For the undergraduate students, it's an issue that students are concerned about for sure, yeah.
What is a typical loan?
I can't speak for all of WashU. It depends going from undergraduate to graduate. I work with just the graduate level. At both levels, the Student Financial Services Office is there to, regardless of what the average debt is, to walk them through the services of repaying it.
Brian, do you have any sense of what kind of debt young people are being saddled with?
We have access to a random sample of credit scores. And so if you restrict the average debt per borrower, so of those people with student debt in the United States between the ages of, you know, 25 and 34, so, you know, younger people, it's about 27,000. Now, this is a little bit higher than most people think, mainly because this includes graduate students, you know, professional students, doctors, things like that. So it's probably a little bit less for undergraduates.
That's a number is a lot lower. It's a big number, but it's a lot lower than numbers a lot of us here with regard to students leaving with $100,000, $150,000 in debt and more.
If you look at the actual distribution, it's only around 5% of people that of borrowers that actually have student loans about above $100,000. So it's not, you know, as prevalent as, you know, some people would have you believe, but it's still, you know, worrisome.
5% would undoubtedly represent tens of thousands of students.
Yeah, that's it's a big chunk of people.
And Joey Khoury, you're free to get up and leave the room now and do something else if you'd like. What are your thoughts as you hear this, and you've been hearing it for a while now?
I believe that if you just go on a college campus and if you looked around at all the students, they look like that they're not concerned with student debt. However, I believe that's because, you know, we are just worried about the near future of let's get an A on that test. Let's hope that our sports team wins the next game. But we are concerned about student loans. It's just on the back of our mind. We're more worried about getting the degree up front, and then let's hope we get a job, and then let's pay off our loans.
This is exacerbated by the fact that there aren't that many jobs out there for college students these days. Are you among the 5% with hefty student loans?
No, fortunately not. According to how much I owe on FAFSA, I have staff.
What is that?
We have an application to the government to borrow from the government thousands of dollars. Of course, we don't get to choose how much money we borrow. They allot a specific amount. But what I got was about $14,000, and I'm very fortunate, very glad to have that.
And that's going to be spread 14,000 times three, correct?
Oh, this is $14,000 up to this point right now.
We'll have
more loans this coming semester.
And then you're off to graduate school. And do you start the process all over again?
Yes. I do have to reapply for loans. The only difference is that I do not get a direct Stafford loan in graduate school. I only get an indirect Stafford loan, which means that, the difference is between those two loans. For a direct Stafford loan, you are not going to have interest accumulate until 6 months after your debt. Actually, excuse me, after your graduation. However, indirect, that interest accumulates over time, and you're required to pay for that interest.
Joey, can I interrupt just real quick? Just to clear up terminology, all of your loans will be direct loans. You have subsidized options as an undergraduate, as well as unsubsidized. At the graduate level, you have unsubsidized direct loans.
My apologies.
Just terminology.
Just explain the Stafford loan. I'm not sure everybody
understands. Direct Stafford
it.
Loan, that's the primary type of federal loan offered to all enrolled students. So you have the unsubsidized and the subsidized Stafford loan. You have the option of the Perkins loan. You have the option of the PLUS, which is the graduate, or the Parent PLUS loan.
Joey, give me some sense, if you don't mind being personal about this, about your approach and your thoughts. I know you're concerned about your grades, and you're concerned about the things, as you indicated, that college students are concerned about. But this is going to be staring you in the face in the years ahead. How do you think about it?
Well, I think I'm very fortunate because before enrolling to college, I was able to cut my costs of student loans. When I was a junior in high school, I was able to enroll into dual credit and courses at a local community college, and I was able to enter my freshman year at St. Louis University with 35 credits, which enabled me to become a sophomore. And when you crunch the numbers on that, when you look at all the credit hours, I saved $35,000, which is tremendous, huge. And that is just a big burden just lifted off my shoulders.
But you do know that down the road
you have bills
to pay.
Correct.
Yeah. I'm glad Joey's here. He's for any students or potential students who are listening, he is a perfect example of how it should be done. So much of avoiding or decreasing student loan debt is done on the front end and sometimes where you even start school. So doing the high school dual credits helps you get out of school much more quickly, even doing a dual degree like Joey's doing. So that minimizes the time that you're there, minimizes your loans, minimizes your payments longer down the road. So even at a school like SLU, a private institution, students can leave with much lower than the average national debt load. So the 5%, the students with the six-figure debt, those really are the outliers. Those are the ones that are much more rare than the students like Joey who are leaving with a four-year private institution with $14,000. But the ones that get the attention are the ones with the $100,000, $200,000 of student debt. But those are much, much more infrequent.
But they are real people facing real issues who want to be educated. And
absolutely.
They have to take on this enormous debt in order to accomplish that. I mean, they're not like deadbeats or people.
No, not at all. But they choose to. I mean, they choose to take on the debt. And the federal government, the repayment options are there to, after they've made that decision, to help get them through repayment successfully so there aren't any adverse effects.
Right. Brian, back to you. With regard to the Fed's involvement in all of this, explain what that is, why your interest is so high enough to host this symposium.
The group that I work at within the Fed is focused on balance sheets, and it's almost impossible to talk about household finance and balance sheets without talking about student debt. It's now the second biggest debt component behind mortgage debt. from our perspective, you know, we can't really advocate policy. We can just inform it. And that's kind of what we're trying to do, is we're trying to, you know, lay down the facts and say, you know, what's the best way forward? What's the future of student debt? So that's kind of the Fed's role.
What sort of a danger, perhaps you can elaborate on what we talked about before, what sort of a danger, if that's the right word, does it pose for the U.S. economy? Higher than mortgage debt, higher than credit card debt? I mean, there's...
It's much lower than mortgage debt, sorry.
I misunderstood. I'm sorry. Okay. Go ahead.
People that have large debt burdens aren't going to go out and start businesses. They're not going to go out and buy houses. So the first order effects would probably be just, you know, a drag on consumption.
Okay. So how do we reverse this, and how do we deal with it?
It's difficult, and I you know, I can't really give policy advice, you know, and it's a very difficult thing to you know, how do you just all of a sudden take down a trillion in student debt.
But everyone seems to be agreed that something is going to have to be done. A way to reverse this trend is going to have to be found.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. And, I think there's a bunch of policy ideas on the table. You know, I've heard people talk about savings-based approaches to college. I think one of the big ones now is income-based repayments. So currently, student debt's kind of a debt contract. So make it more like an equity contract where repayment's based to income, future income. You know, there are ideas like that on the table.
Matt, how about you? Some of the ideas that you hear being floated about.
In terms of reversing it, it'll be an uphill battle. But in terms of preventing it from ballooning anymore, it really is students and families preparing to take those steps beforehand and talking about transferring in credits, looking at not only the when choosing a college, not only the tuition and fees, but the total cost of attendance. So what's going to cost to live there? What's the dorm? What's the meal plan going to be like? Can you work while you're in school and pay towards your balance then instead of taking out additional loans? Can you go for other grants and scholarships? So really rooting out every other possible resource. When I sit down with a student, I tell them, you know, you can pay a number of ways, and the last ditch effort is the student loans. They should be there as a backup only. That's the best advice that a student can get, so that they know that even though they're offered loans, they don't have to take them.
What about loan forgiveness? You hear that expression, that term,
absolutely,
pop up from time to time. Is there any realistic chance that could happen?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the biggest one is the public service loan forgiveness, which is a federal program for students going into the public service field, social work, public health professionals, anyone going and working for a 501c3 nonprofit, state, local, federal government, things like that, where after making 120 on-time, full, successful repayments, the remaining amount can be forgiven if they're under one of those approved repayment plans, which, as was just mentioned, income-based is one of them, which is the big one that the White House has been pushing over the last couple of years.
Joey, you're obviously in a somewhat different situation than the most extreme cases that we've talked about here, but how much time and effort did you spend looking into this as you were planning your college career?
To be quite honest, entering students to college, they look at that loan right away, and that's the same for me. We think that the first line of defense is that loan. So there really isn't much incentive right away to look at scholarships or grants, because we see the dollar signs right away. Is that the right way to approach it? No. We should be looking at all these scholarships, the grants first, like it was previously stated.
You've mentioned that your colleagues and your peers are certainly aware of what's going on. What do they say? How much do they talk about it? And what do they say when they are talking about it?
It's really kind of the elephant in the room. We all know it's there. We barely mention it, but we would much rather like to focus on other things. But when it comes, when we do talk about it, we talk about, can I get a job right now to pay for this, a part-time job? If I do have this job, how many hours do I have to work? So it's when it's barely mentioned, it seems a little worrisome.
I would think it would be. Why is it that the tuition rate has been growing at a faster rate than the inflation rate, Brian?
You know, one of the reasons recently is state funding for higher education has gone down. So schools have kind of had to, you know, either cut costs or increase tuition. Part of it is, you know, just a demand increase. You know, a lot more people now go to college. I think the percentage of people with a college degree has been trending up since I think the 40s. So there's a lot of factors that are going into tuition increases.
What do you hope comes out of the symposium?
My main hope is that we get people talking about it, and, you know, we get some ideas on the table for the future, and how can we decrease this burden on so many Americans.
And what kind of a group do you have there to try to come up with these suggestions?
My group is small and mighty. I think there's five of us and a group of researchers that are really focused on household finance. So what we analyze is the balance sheet, and it's understudied. Most people look at income. We're looking at what do people have, and how does this affect outcomes?
Matt, back to you with regard to the role of universities. One of the things that we're hearing a lot about these days is the growth of online education. Do you think that this can have a bearing and have an impact on this whole debt issue?
It'll depend, really, possibly. It depends on what their tuition model is going to be like and how many students take it instead of going to the typical brick and mortar campus situation or campus type university. So it's possible, but I couldn't say for sure because it hasn't been around long enough to really get a sense of how many students are going there as opposed to the classic college.
Joey, do you have any sense that this might be at least a partial solution?
I can't give you an answer on that, but when you're applying for college, the major schools that you are thinking about are not online schools. You're thinking about the most notarized schools in the media. For instance, if you just look at the NCAA tournament, it's just a basketball tournament, but you've got more than 64 schools out there. That is just free advertisement. So when you apply to schools, you're immediately thinking those 64 teams of that year right away. And then you'll branch out to look at, well, how much money will this school give me, or what degree programs will this school give me?
When you think about all the hundreds of millions of dollars that that tournament and other college athletics really pump into the economy, you think that some of that might be a good proportion might be used for student aid.
Oh, yes. That money does, at least I know at St. Louis University, we pride ourselves that we're not just an institution of athletics. We really do take care of our athletes. We make sure that they get the proper tutoring services. They make sure that all their needs are met academically. And so even though that money doesn't come back in the form of scholarships for the non-athlete, we do try to make sure that those athletes make sure they get a great education.
Well, you're very diplomatic in saying that. I would just wonder if there's any sense of resentment over that.
No, not at all.
All right. Our time is winding down. I want to go around the table and ask each of you to put a bottom line on this and what you think can be done, even if it's slightly repetitive. Where do we go from here, Matt? We'll start with you.
Again, I think it's the planning ahead, figuring out what your overall cost of attendance is going to be and how you can address that and manage it without taking out loans or before taking out loans, using them as, a last-ditch effort, planning, looking at different schools, comparing the costs overall, and then deciding after you complete the FAFSA, if and how much loans you want to take out.
And Brian, from the Fed perspective, your thoughts?
I should mention that this is from my perspective. These aren't
sure,
necessarily
I get it.
The
we get it.
But no, I have to agree with Matt. College is it's a big investment. It's a very costly investment. 4 years of tuition, 4 years of lost income. So people should be very careful and really take time.
Is this sort of thing going on in other of the Fed districts across the country, this concern and work with regard to student loans?
I've seen some other researchers around the Fed doing some work on it. I know people from the Kansas City Fed and the Dallas Fed specifically, and I'm sure other people are, because we actually have access to kind of a data set that nobody else does that's really good on student loans. So yes, it's gone.
Okay. And Joey, last but certainly not least, let me turn to you. Yeah, your best advice to fellow students and students-to-be in higher education, and your thoughts, final thoughts on this.
First off, know if college is right for you. And if you think college is right for you, I would say this is the outline that you need to follow. Freshman year of high school, start thinking what you want to do. And then by the time sophomore or junior year of high school, you can start enrolling into a community college or these dual credit programs and pick the classes that are specifically like electives that wouldn't pertain to what you think your future major would be. Because if you pick one of those classes, say you want to be a physics major and you take a physics class, most often those colleges will not accept that requirement because they want to make sure that you get that specialized education that the college requires. So I would say knock out those electives and knock out the cost.
Sounds like good advice to me. I want to thank you, gentlemen, so much for being with us. You just heard from Joey Khoury, who is a junior at St. Louis University. He's going to graduate early next May and go on to graduate school. Best of success, Joey, to you as you pursue that objective.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being with us. Also with us is Matthew Newland, Assistant Director of Financial Aid at the Brown School of Social Work at Washington University, and Brian Noeth is with the St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank. Thank you all so much for being with us. Good luck at your symposium.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk about the art of letter writing. Is it becoming a lost art? Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.